Welcome to Spill Radio. This program is being recorded on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. I am Tatiana Melema, hosting this program on behalf of the Morris and Helen Belkin Art Gallery at the University of British Columbia. Spill Radio is presented in collaboration with CITR 101.9 FM, with sound production and editing by Joshua Stevenson. This program seeks to engage radio as a site for relational study. We are particularly interested in the possibilities of what collective listening can bring to the Belkin's exhibition Spill. In this exhibition, artists engage real-time research and performance on extractive capital, and in particular, continental waters and the conditions of their impaired movement, contamination, and political rights. Today's episode will include an interview hosted by Lorna Brown, who is the acting director-curator of the Belkin Art Gallery, with Susan Shupley, whose new series of works in Spill are related to the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Shupley is an artist and researcher based in London, whose work examines material evidence from war and conflict to environmental disasters. In particular, she investigates the challenges that contaminated environments pose for making truth claims that turn on the legal question of direct causality. Her artistic process involves working directly with scientists and lawyers, often bringing different materials and perspectives together to create new critical vantage points or to produce a counter-narrative. Shupley's book, Material Witness, Media, Forensics, Evidence, will be published by MIT Press in 2020. And she is currently the director of the Center for Research Architecture and board chair of Forensic Architecture at Goldsmiths.
So, Susan, in your work, nature represents itself about the Deepwater Horizon disaster. You're working with a few layers of what the word represent or representation means. Part of your proposal is that the computer-generated video is an example of how an oil slick generates the cinematic mode in itself, a kind of lurid genre that results from the interaction of oil molecules, light, and the water's surface tension. Could you talk a bit more about this and about how this work sits in relation to other representations of what we might call the slow violence of extractive industry and resulting calamities?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. Thanks, Lorna, for the provocative question. One of the things that I was trying to prompt with this title was to ask, well, if nature can be a legal agent, then why not? We need to also take seriously the possibility that nature could be an aesthetic agent fully capable of representing its own interests. So how to make an artwork about that? I've been very interested for quite some time looking at other proto-cinematic or other proto-photographic kind of processes. So ways in which a certain interaction that we might identify, for example, with photography or celluloid film, that is to say, the capture of energetic quanta from the light. So light in combination with a chemical interaction that then results in producing visible surface effects. That's by and large what the photo process is. It's what chlorophyll does in plants. It's also what happens when hydrocarbon atoms interact with water. They produce a kind of refractive condition. They move light around in particular ways, and they also create a certain kind of smoothing effect, which is when there's an oil spill, it actually smooths the kind of agitation of the surface, producing literally a film. And scientists technically refer to oil spills as oil films. And so for me, this was very kind of important in trying to talk about and make work about this particular environmental catastrophe, in part because there was such an extensive media ban on the part of British Petroleum. When we're talking about representation in the context of this work, it's both legal and it's aesthetic. But the reason that I had to produce a simulation was I'm arguing for the self-generating kind of image-making capacity of nature or of an ecological system. And so it wouldn't have made sense for me to then, say, take an image of an oil spill or to recreate an oil spill. I thought I needed to actually come up with some way of producing a kind of a system that could self-generate an image. And so this is why I turned to computational simulations. So what is actually happening in that video are billions and billions of particles have been released into computational space with the same attributes of hydrocarbons of the crude oil hydrocarbons that were spills in the Gulf of Mexico. And so scientists would use these kinds of software modeling programs to understand hydrodynamics and fluid dynamics, actually. And so I used the same kind of system. It was a kind of conceptual necessity for me because I needed to somehow figure out a way that an image could be self-generated by matter itself. And and so I used not analog materials, but I used digital materials to kind of make that conceptual argument with, if you will.
Yeah, so this kind of struggle over visual representation, like part of the project are a set of images that you call slick images. And they're composites of satellite images, these press images that have been doctored and altered, and also crowdsourced aerial shots. And that these together seem to testify to a struggle over how this particular disaster, the Deepwater Horizon spill, it was pictured and imagined. Could you maybe just talk a bit, sketch out that struggle for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened in the immediate aftermath of this explosion on the oil rig and the early days of the leak, there was immediately a total media ban imposed on the part of BP. This was in some way, ironically, they weren't able ultimately to contain the spill, but they did a fairly good job at containing the kind of like image responders to the event, insofar as it was largely the U.S. Coast Guard that had official sanction to actually publicize images, and of course the images that BP's press office were releasing. And what that did include was the real-time underwater video stream. So we do have underwater footage of a certain kind of murky nature. And what you see are the various attempts over the many months to try and cap that leak. So despite the sort of immediate ban to like journalists, which also involved a ban on sort of flyovers by helicopters, et cetera, et cetera. So a fairly kind of comprehensive and thorough strategy on the part of the corporation to really control and manage the media response and access. At the same time, there are certain forms of image capture that were taking place that were out of their hands. And one of those, of course, are Earth orbiting satellite images. So Landsat, which is owned by NASA, was, you know, continually taking images of the spill because that's part of its route as it traverses around around the sort of area circumference of the globe. So in the exhibition, what you have are two Landsat images. So these are forms of automated image capture. There's the underwater footage. There's, as you mentioned, the attempt at the two doctored images that BP released, which show that they are conducting round-the-clock kind of monitoring of the spill. But in fact, what happened was some of the monitors were actually turned off, and they photoshopped those blank or dead monitors to suggest kind of greater oversight of the accident. And then something I think quite significant also happened, which was a kind of citizen activism initiative called Public Lab emerged. And Public Lab, it's not so much crowdsourced, but Public Lab developed strategies for producing aerial images through very simple mechanisms of kites and balloons. So attaching a GoPro or a camera to a kite or to a balloon. And then you can imagine as that camera is taking pictures and the wind is moving the kite around, you're getting all kinds of strange angles and things like that. So Public Lab has developed certain tools for stitching all of those hundreds of images together. So you can produce, in effect, what they call a kind of citizen satellite. It was precisely because of the ways in which there was a kind of systematic attempt to ensure that images of this creeping spill and the scale, which was so kind of extraordinary, somehow would not leak into the hands of local communities. And Public Lab demonstrated that despite that kind of prohibition, it was still possible to produce some form of representation in the face of this catastrophe. But my work in some way was a reminder that there was yet one more image system that was fully operative, that was producing an image of the catastrophe, and that was the oil spill itself as it creeped across the surface waters of the Gulf. Right. Precisely because the oil spill is in fact a kind of oil film. And of course, I think it's also probably worth mentioning that, you know, all celluloid film itself was a consequence of, is a consequence of oil. So you also have that other sort of kind of historical reference. But that's in a sense the kind of, the entry point in the work for me was really through the regime of the image, the prohibition against the image, and then all of the ways in which one might want to sort of argue, you know, that images are still being made despite this kind of censorship that's being imposed, both by activist groups, but also by materials themselves.
We also, though, have the audio portion of the project, and it's a sound recording of the charges against British Petroleum in that lawsuit that was filed in Ecuador that proposed that under universal jurisdiction, the ocean or nature itself has a legal right to defend itself and to represent itself. You maybe talk a little bit about the process of making the recording itself.
Sure. Yes, yeah, so Ecuador does have a very unique constitution, and we are probably aware through media or through the news that other natural entities have been given quasi-legal rights, like a river in New Zealand, et cetera, et cetera. So, but this, because of having... Not only do they have a Pachamama constitution in which nature has certain intractable legal rights, they also abide by the universal, the principle of universal jurisdiction, and as does Canada. And universal jurisdiction is a legal concept that means that one can actually indict, charge and run a trial in a jurisdiction in which the crime did not occur. So that principle is very, very important because it means that legal action can take place outside of the jurisdiction in which the violation occurred. The reason that that is so is important because in many instances, one would require regime change in order to actually have a kind of trial. So with Ecuador, we have these two very unique conditions that are part of their national constitution. One, that nature has inalienable rights, and two, the principle of universal jurisdiction. So Ecuador made the rather kind of radical legal move to file a lawsuit against British Petroleum based on the rights of the sea. And they made a series of demands. That lawsuit ultimately was unsuccessful. What's more important, I think, is the ways in which they conceptualize what might be a kind of response to the tragedies. So rather than simply arguing for, you know, financial compensation, which is often the case, there were demands for remediation. There were all kinds of demands that were raised that didn't necessarily organize around the kind of logic of finance capital that ultimately was, if you will, was the very logic that also, of course, produced the accidents. With regards to most environmental violations, what we have within the Anglo-American legal tradition, which is also the Canadian one, of course, is the burden of proving direct causality if you want to find someone criminally responsible. We know that environmental contaminants don't operate according to direct causal principles, right? What was demonstrated by this lawsuit was a certain, as I said, a radicalization of the law and an attempt to kind of redirect its capacities and use it in ways that weren't necessarily intended, but also to push it to foreground the kind of extraordinary possibility that the concept of universal jurisdiction has.
We, the plaintiffs, are filing this lawsuit because it is an ethical imperative in these times when even the most optimistic voices warn that humankind is losing its future, because the model of growth, overexploitation, and plunder based on fossil fuel is robbing us of that future. Because the oil decline is pushing the industry beyond the limits of reason, and operations are moving into extraordinarily fragile areas where there is no turning back. Because we recognize ourselves as men and women who depend on the air to breathe, on the water to revitalize us, refresh us, and give us life, on the species that surround us to maintain the balance of life and the planet, to astonish us with their beauty and amaze us with the immense capacity for collaboration and solidarity among the species found in nature, on the sea, which holds the secrets of existence in its vastness, and is the birthplace of life as we know it. Because it is the only way that we can honor our original ancestors, who safeguarded and protected nature in order to offer us the legacy of a place where we could make our dreams a reality. And because, in turn, it is the only way we can pass down to the men and women that our children will become, a place where they can make their dreams a reality. Because the international system of rights does not recognize the rights of nature, and as a result, the precautionary principle and compensation for impacts on nature are limited to uses and abuses as they relate to people and do not extend to nature or Pachamama in her own right, nor to the different species with whom we coexist. We are filing this lawsuit because the international system of rights is clearly biased towards protecting the interests of transnational corporations that make excessive, irresponsible, and predatory use of the rights to property and free enterprise based on a development philosophy that is antagonistic to nature.
If you put the headphones on, the audio, I feel really sort of, it produces another kind of audio track for the piece. You still see the same images, but you're hearing a highly kind of technical legal language that's unfolding. And I thought that was in some way a kind of useful device for sort of cutting through that, you know, what we've talked about, the more kind of sublime sort of dimension of certain kinds of images, which there's no question that these, you know, highly lurid kinds of oil spill. The oil spill does produce these certain kinds of chimeric hallucinogenic images that are quite mesmerizing. So the function of the audio when you put on the headphones is you enter into a different moment, a kind of legal register that really kind of, I think, punctures that or cuts through in some way or produces friction with that sort of those images that are still moving. And then if you take the headphones off, you're back in these other moments. So you're moving between these two different kinds of, I guess, representational realities. You know, I think it's a fantastic exhibition if it can just with all of the different projects, if it can start to, in some way, I guess, produce a certain kind of public discourse such that the, as I said before, such that the act of disclosing harm is in some way at least coupled with this kind of a speculation as to possible ways in which to intervene, act, or respond to these kinds of events, right? So even at the level of just of kind of public discussion, these podcasts, et cetera, right? I think this is what I think where all of the kind of work has to happen on sort of multiple kind of registers, of which the exhibition space is one, but all of the ways in which that work then starts to mobilize different kinds of kind of public discussions, of course, is extremely important.
Thanks so much, Susan. It's been really great to talk to you, and I really look forward to your visit. And thanks once again.